the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take 2, me, Martinez. One of the changes you'll see when you walk into a voting center is the old machines are history, replaced with ballot marking devices. We'll hear what some voters thought of them seconds after using them. Plus, there's still a lot we don't know about coronavirus. That's what can make it scary. But there are things we do know and have answers to. Hear that and more when Take 2 kicks off in just a few. Stick around. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Happy Super Tuesday. Happy voting day. Remember, polls close at 8. If you haven't cast your ballot, there's still time, so relax a little bit. But if you have voted, though, go ahead and safely pat yourself on the back. All right, so as you probably have heard, there has been a lot of pressure building up toward this day. Not only is this the earliest presidential primary for California voters, the process is totally different. Los Angeles County election officials have spent years overhauling our voting system and have spent about $300 million to do so. Traditional polling places have been replaced with voting centers, and voters now use touchscreens to cast a ballot. Behold, technology. How about that? Now, to get a sense of how voters are feeling about the new system, we took a short trip out to the Altadena Community Center this morning to catch folks as they were leaving the polls, and here's what we heard.
Why did you decide to come here as opposed to vote by mail?
It's close, but next time I will be voting by mail from now on.
Why? What happened in there?
I just waited like almost an hour and a half in there. I have a 90-year-old mother. She cannot do that. So from now on, vote by mail.
So the process, the actual machines and everything, that went really well.
That went well. I'm surprised, you know, because I'm really skeptical. But, you know, the name would come up and you just tap the screen and it would say, okay. Or you could skip. If you didn't like who they had, you could just skip, which I did a lot of skipping.
One of the things that I got to mention too, with coronavirus all in the news, small space, lots of people in line. Were you worried about that at all coming here?
No, I think it's overblown. I deliver packages all day. I'm with people, I'm in different places. So I would stay home if I was that worried. But yeah, I don't worry about that stuff.
So you just showed up here, but now you're leaving. Why'd you
leave? We're going to try to go up. There's a place called Farnsworth Park. It's a little bit bigger room, and we're thinking maybe it might go a little quicker.
What were you expecting to see, or what were you hoping to see when you got here?
Nobody here, and I could just walk right in and vote.
How ready are you for the machines themselves? We've heard about how new they are. And
I'm not ready at all for the machines.
No.
You know, so I'm going to, you know, go through the process and see how it goes.
Now, wondering one more thing, considering everything in the news about coronavirus, mm-hmm. It's a small space.
The minute we walked in, somebody sneezed too.
And no so, kidding.
Yes,
wow.
That happened. Yeah.
Did that frighten you at all?
Got my attention. There's a bigger room over there, so maybe it would be less. If somebody sneezes, it might get dispersed a little bit better up there too.
So why come here as opposed to maybe voting by mail?
I like the experience of coming in to see how many other people in my community have voted, run into neighbors and see what they're doing. If I don't see them at the poll, I miss the days when they used to put the list out so I could go and harass people and say, you didn't go vote yet.
When it comes to everything that was on the ballot, how prepared would you say you were on?
Very. 10 friends of mine from high school and I still text. They're all very politically active. And so we talked about the measures, FD and 13 and all of those.
Okay. And one more thing, when it comes to everyone being in a small space with everything we hear in the news about coronavirus, were you at all worried? Did you have Purell? Did you make sure you washed your hands?
I'm a germophobic. And when I came out of the door, if you can see, yes, I had hand sanitizer because everybody's touching the screen.
Why come here instead of voting by mail?
I don't want to do the app because I'm just worried about tampering. But I am going to go in my car and grab a pen and just put my mail-in ballot in the ballot box.
So you were in line and you decided to leave the line?
I did.
Are you worried that it's going to take way too much time than you maybe budgeted for?
I'm just kind of nervous about voting today because I'm having a hard time coming to grips with my presidential candidate choice. So standing in the line is not going to really benefit me in the long run.
Standing in the line would have given you too much time to think or rethink?
I've already been, you know, waffling and then going back and forth about the choices, and I need to put that behind me.
That was Kim Harden, Lance Anderson, Sherry Davis Johnson, and Christina Bell. And Christina, wherever you are, Godspeed. All right, let's turn now to KPCC's Sharon McNary. She's been all over town today. Hello, Sharon.
Hey there, A.
All right, Sharon, now where are you? What's going on where you are?
Okay, I'm at Montrose Library. That's just north of Glendale. And I am astonished at the number of people waiting in line here. There's like 40 people, and it goes up one row of bookshelves and down the other and across the window. It's an impressive turnout.
Yeah, I was at Altadena Community Center earlier today. Same thing. The line was starting to get really long. And then we went to a voting center nearby at a park. And some of the people that were in the Altadena Community Center line were in that line. I kind of looked at them and pointed. And they said, yeah, we know. We should have stayed in line. Now, in our next segment, Sharon, we're going to look more closely at who has turned out to vote so far. But from what you've seen, a lot of people at the polls today, right? Because it's just lines seem to be the one thing people are complaining about the most.
Well, I mean, it wasn't long lines everywhere. I woke up this morning and got out to Norwalk before 7 o'clock. And boy, if you ever want to vote on TV, that is the place to go because there's a lineup of TV cameras there and anybody wanted to be interviewed could be. I also went to East LA where there was just a steady stream of people in and out, but not a long line because they had so many machines there. In Baldwin Hills, I saw about 25 to 30 people in a line, and it was in the Baha'i Center, so the line was kind of going around. And here in Montrose, that's the longest line I've seen all day. In fact, I was telling people how to do the app so you can pre-put your vote in.
Yeah.
And then have it scanned when you get up to the counter.
Yeah, a lot of people that I ran into did exactly that. People seem generally pleased, though, Sharon, with the new system. I mean, what did you hear from voters on that?
Generally, very pleased. Yeah. You know, I mean, I talked to this old lady who only started to vote in 1988. Her first language is Spanish. And she said she found it very easy to understand and do.
I saw a 93-year-old World War II veteran who said, if you ask me 2 weeks from now, I probably won't be able to tell you how to do it. But if you ask me tomorrow, I'll remember how to work the new system. Now, earlier today, I alluded to the pressure building up to today. A lot of money, a lot of time was spent to revamp it all. And there was a worry about whether it would work as planned. Can you give us a little background as to how we got here with this revamped process?
Absolutely. You remember the Hanging Chads disaster in Florida that was the Gore and Bush election?
I do. A long time ago, yeah.
That led Congress to spend a lot of money on better voting systems. A lot of the counties took that money, spent it, and the machines were not very good. LA County actually sat on the money for a lot of years. And so when everybody else was looking for their second generation, LA was still thinking about creating its first, and the registrar recorder, Dean Logan, had this vision of doing crowdsourcing and reaching out to stakeholders and figuring out, like, what's the best way for people who want to vote? How can we make people vote the way they want to? Lots of different hours, any ability or disability, many languages, many places. And that's kind of what they've come up with. I mean, this is for a first time, I'm actually pretty surprised how well it seems to be going despite the wait.
So, okay, a few hours to go before the polls close at 8. Can LA County maybe dip their toe in the pool of calling it a success, or still too early?
I'm going to give it a measured yes. I mean, we haven't counted anything yet.
No.
You know, here in California, we'd rather have it right than fast. Because of all the different ways we give people to register. I mean, you could walk into a polling place today and register to vote. And so that does mean it takes longer to count. So we got to wait for that.
All right. This is KPCC's Sharon McNary. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
All right, now joining me to talk about Election Day, the way we cast our ballot, and what it could all mean for voter turnout is KPCC's data journalist, Aaron Mendelson. What's up, Aaron?
Hi, eh?
All right, this election, stakes are very high, not just the candidates on the ballot, but also the way we vote.
Right, as Sharon was just talking about, we're trying out something new here in Southern California with these vote centers. If you have already been to vote in Los Angeles or Orange County, maybe you found your old polling place wasn't in operation. There have been a lot of concerns that longtime voters might not know where to go. Election officials are telling us these are just the birth pangs of a better system. The vote centers let you vote anywhere in the county. There's nearly 1,000 of them just in LA County, and you can go vote at any one of them. So you can vote at the Hammer Museum in UCLA, even if you live in Pomona.
Oh, wow.
Although you might not want to. Apparently, there's very long lines at the Hammer today.
Oh,
The vote centers have been open for over a week in some cases, so they're not just for election day. They tried this system out. They rolled it out in some parts of the state 2 years ago. And it's all really part of a years-long effort to make voting easier. So if we don't see more people at the polls, that's going to be considered a failure.
Oh, wow. Okay, so today's election, also a big test of our primary day too, right?
Right. California made another bet, a bid to become relevant in the presidential primary. We are voting much earlier this year, if you remember back to 2016. Our primary was in June. Of course, it's early March right now. And that's really put us in the spotlight for the presidential primaries. You know, we've seen candidates campaigning all over the state. Michael Bloomberg was buying Super Bowl ads that voters saw from Imperial County to Crescent City. You saw Bernie Sanders holding a huge rally at the LA Convention Center on Sunday. And so moving the date up has meant that Californians' votes really matter this time around, and that excitement could boost turnout.
I saw a couple of places I went to in Altadena, long lines this morning. What do we know about how many people are voting?
Well, I spoke to election officials in LA County about an hour ago. They told me about 477,000 people had used the vote centers so far. About 575,000 people have mailed in their ballots and already had it show up at headquarters. So more than a million votes cast already. That would put turnout at about 19% if no one else voted and all those ballots were counted. And of course, those numbers are going to keep climbing.
Now, what do we know about the votes that have already been cast?
Well, they haven't been tallied or anything, but there is a company called Political Data that tracks vote-by-mail returns. Their tracker shows over 16 million ballots were mailed out in the state this year. About 4 million of those have been returned so far, and at this point, older voters, white voters, and Republicans have turned in their ballots at a higher rate. Of course, there are many more registered Democrats in the state than Republicans, and more Democratic ballots have been returned overall, close to 2 million.
And those those numbers actually will still rise since people are still throwing in their ballots. They're voting.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Polls are still open. If you haven't cast a ballot yet, you can still go to a vote center until 8 p.m., or a traditional polling place if you're in Riverside or San Bernardino County. And just a reminder for listeners, if you're in line at 8 p.m., stay in line. You're allowed to vote so long as you're in line by 8 p.m. But all these laws mean that votes won't arrive at county election offices right away, not at 8:01 or anything. You know, in L.A., sheriff's deputies actually transport the ballots, in some cases by helicopter or by boat. And they all go to Downey, where the votes are counted. Election officials won't even have all the votes tonight. They're still going to be receiving votes that people put in the mail, you know, today. So it could take a while.
Now, yeah, that's one of the questions that Sharon mentioned, that we take our time here in California. When will we know winners, who they are?
Yeah, I think late this evening we'll have a good sense about a lot of races, but officials actually have a month to count all the votes. And really close races, with those, we might not have the results for days or potentially weeks. That also holds for voter turnout. We should know relatively soon if it was a high or low turnout election, but any number you hear today or tomorrow, that's going to rise as more votes are counted. And that's basically the trade-off we've decided to make here in California. We've made it easier to vote, but that just means it takes longer to count.
That's KPCC's Aaron Mendelson telling us about turnout and what to expect tonight. Aaron, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
All right, moving on. For more than a century, farmers in California have drilled deep into the ground to get any extra water they need to fuel their crops, especially during times of drought. There's never been a limit to how much they could take, but that's all about to change. After the state passed the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act in 2014, dozens of local agencies have submitted plans to control their groundwater resources. Susie Cagle is a climate and environment reporter for The Guardian US. She joins us now to discuss. Susie, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks, A. Happy to be here.
Now, you've been covering this historic water law in your series, Watered Down. It's the first time California is regulating groundwater. What does the law do? What's it looking to accomplish?
Well, it's looking to make those important groundwater levels more sustainable over time. A vast majority of people in the Central Valley rely on groundwater to drink and cook and bathe, 95% of people in the Central Valley, but it also fuels the state's $50 billion agriculture industry. So groundwater is super important, but we're losing it. Nearly 600 billion gallons are lost in the Central Valley each year. That's stuff that's pumped out, and it never ends up back in the aquifer.
Yeah, so farmers just grab water when they needed it, right? That's kind of the reason why lawmakers started to think about this?
Yeah, it was just anarchy. And during the last drought, California's worst drought ever, suddenly wells across the entire Central Valley were just going dry. There wasn't enough water for everyone that needed it.
Now, the law is expected to affect small farmers disproportionately. What does that mean for them? What groups in California will be the hardest hit?
So the law doesn't really regulate water just yet. They're talking about this glide path. So over the next 20 years, as we try to reach sustainability by 2040, we'll actually have less and less water over time. These plans are trying to figure it out, but it's complicated. It's tricky. There's a lot of people who need that water. And the people who have the most shallow wells are going to be impacted first, right? They can't reach that water as it gets lower and lower over time. So those are the smallest farmers. A lot of times people who are just renting land, they don't even own the land and they don't own their well. And individual people who live in rural areas and they own their own wells for their own homes.
Yeah, so these smaller farmers just don't have the resources, right, to be able to maybe adapt to this when it actually happens.
Absolutely. They can't get water from other places. Larger farms are looking at trying to buy more water, get water from diverted rivers and streams, buy it from the Delta in Northern California. And when we're talking about small farmers, maybe just 10 acres of vegetables, they just can't afford those things.
Talking to Susie Cagle, climate and environment reporter for The Guardian U.S. Susie, you've talked to several small farmers and people who depend on private wells for their drinking water. This February has been the driest in 150 years. What have they been telling you?
I think people were a little more optimistic a few weeks ago. They can look up at the Sierra Nevada mountains and see there is some snowpack there.
Yeah.
And these are all people that made it through that worst drought in state history. But they are worried. There are people who are talking about maybe the end of farming. They're talking about retirement. But when it comes to younger farmers, I think there is really a concern about making this resource sustainable because they don't want to stop farming and they know that everyone relies on it and they need to share better.
Yeah, you mentioned one in your piece right off the top. She's in her 30s, right? And she wants to be farming for the next 40 years, but maybe not, considering that this might be something that might break her.
Yeah, Nikiko Masumoto, her family has owned that land for decades, since the late 1940s, and she's not looking at stopping. She's trying to kind of recharge the aquifer on her own and look at different strategies, but I think she's kind of the exception in the Central Valley. For the most part, people are really hoping that this glide path, this kind of slow decline towards sustainability, is going to allow them enough flexibility to figure something else out in the next 20 years. People don't want to stop farming. There's a lot of money in it still.
Yeah, and for California, I mean, they provide, what, two-thirds of the nation's fruits and nuts, California farmers? That's more than a third of its vegetables, too. I mean, what are groundwater rights like before this Sustainable Groundwater Management Act? You mentioned how it's anarchy, but it sounds like there used to be a lot. Now there might not be as much.
Yeah, I think in the future, experts have talked about to try to make this sustainable, we're just going to have to fallow fields. Maybe 500,000 to 1 million acres of farmland in California, in the Central Valley especially, is going to have to go fallow. But at the same time, that means that farmers are motivated to really use that water to its most valuable purpose. So they're planting permanent crops like nuts that can fetch a higher price than things like vegetables. But the country still relies on those vegetables and those fruits, even though they're not as expensive.
Is this going to be one of those situations, Susie, where just the big, rich farmers, the ones maybe that have corporate backing, will be able to survive this, and the small farmers, or as you mentioned, maybe might have to think of something else to do with their lives?
That's definitely what advocates are fearing. That's certainly one big potential outcome of what otherwise seemed like, you know, the thing that we have to do to make California sustainable.
Anything else that California is doing to try and address the state's water problems?
Oh, gosh. One of the biggest things in 2019, California finally passed the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund to try to kind of fill the gap, especially at least when it comes to residents, people living with those individual wells. You know, when your well goes dry, it's kind of like if your roof fails, it's your own property, you're responsible for it. And now with this new fund, with billions of dollars behind it, there will at least be some aid for those individual well owners.
Susie Cagle is the environment reporter for The Guardian. Susie, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
All right, it seems like nowadays you can't listen to news without hearing something about the spread of coronavirus. And I know that can make you feel worried, scared even. We get it. There is still a lot we do not know. However, there is plenty that we do know, and we're ready to answer your questions. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. So stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. All right, now on to the latest news surrounding the coronavirus. Today, the World Health Organization announced that the mortality rate for COVID-19 is 3.4%. That's up from 2%. As of the latest count, there are over 90,000 cases and 3,000 deaths worldwide related to the coronavirus. Most of those are in China. In California, there are far fewer cases, about 40 of them, only one in Los Angeles and one in Orange County. Still, though, people are concerned, and many of you have sent in questions asking about it. And so to answer some of those questions about COVID-19 and how Southern California is dealing with the epidemic is Barbara Ferrer, director of the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health. Doctor, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So I want to start with a question from one of our listeners, and that's Radik Kotari. Here it is.
My question is, once the coronavirus is infected in a person, how does it work? I mean, what does it do to our cells? We know the symptoms and all that. So how does it actually work?
So there you go, doctor. So once coronavirus is infected, how does it all work? Where does it go?
I think, you know, it's a great question. You know, I think the science behind viruses is that they obviously are attacking healthy cells in people. In this case, it's a respiratory illness primarily. So it really affects how your lungs may be working, which is why, you know, we sometimes see people who have shortness of breath, they're having a hard time breathing, they may be coughing. You know, the virus itself tends to live in the nose and the mouth of folks that are infected, but obviously it travels and can affect other parts of the body. And it just, as with all viruses, you know, unfortunately, you know, this is a case where an antibiotic does not work, and we don't have an antiviral medication that we can offer specific to the novel coronavirus. We are left with having really excellent healthcare workers and health facilities treat the symptoms that you may develop should you become ill with novel coronavirus. We call it COVID-19 is the disease caused by the virus. So should you become ill, you know, we're well able to manage your symptoms and treat your symptoms, but we don't have a medication that's directly able to stop the virus from replicating in your body and continuing to cause illness. It really usually runs its course. Then it clears, your immune system is able to fight it off, and you return to a state of, you know, not being infectious and not having symptoms.
And Rudy Kotori said that we know the systems, but as I understand it, Doctor, the majority of people infected are asymptomatic. Is that one of the big problems LA County is bracing itself for?
We have no evidence that suggests that the majority of people are asymptomatic. We have evidence that suggests that it can cause fairly mild disease for many people. And when I say mild disease, that could be disease where you're not even running a temperature or fever. You don't have a fever, but you have the symptoms that we mostly associate with a cold. You know, you may be coughing or sneezing a fair amount. You may even have a productive cough. You know, you may feel congested. But you're actually not feeling ill like you might have influenza or some of the other diseases that often mimic what novel coronavirus can do to our system. But I would not say that most people are asymptomatic. We have no evidence to suggest that. We have evidence that suggests that a lot of people may have mild disease or moderate disease.
Now, another question regarding the virus itself comes from Justin Butler, who asks, can the coronavirus leave a person's body without any medication or treatment?
Sure. I mean, that's what it does. I mean, your immune system will clear this virus. That works best for relatively healthy people. It's a little bit harder for people of underlying health conditions, and particularly for people who are already immune compromised. Their immune system isn't really easily able to mount the full response. But actually, that's exactly what does happen, is your body mounts the defense. The defense clears away the virus, and you no longer are infectious. You're not shedding any virus. You can't infect other people, and you, in fact, feel better.
So if someone, doctor, were to go to the ER and say there's a way to tell if they have it or not, what gets given to them right off? Is there anything that gets given to them right off the bat to deal with this?
No, and, you know, let me just start by suggesting that, you know, we really urge people, please don't go to the ER unless you have an emergency, a life-threatening emergency, or you're told by your primary care doctor that you need to go to the emergency room. You know, obviously, we're going to see more illness, and although most people will experience mild or moderate illness associated with COVID-19, some people will actually have serious illness. And they need to be able to rely on having enough staff and rooms in our hospital settings to treat those who most need to go. But the basic question is a very sensible question. You know, if I am diagnosed, and we can talk a little bit about how you get diagnosed, sure. But if I were to be diagnosed, what would a clinical staff people be offering me? And it really would depend on your symptoms. Obviously, if you're diagnosed and you have very mild symptoms, you know, it's sort of rest, you know, maybe take some Tylenol or some Advil if you're running a low fever, make sure you're staying hydrated, make sure you're watching for any other more alarming symptoms. You're having a hard time breathing. But it really would be, you know, what we would tell most people, if you have mild illness, you know, stay home, rest. Avoid contacting other people. Please don't go to work. Please don't go to school. Please don't go circulating in your community while you get well. The treatment, you know, what you may be offered by a clinician is really to treat your symptoms. So, for example, if you have a fever, you'll be given a fever-reducing medication. If you were having a hard time breathing, depending on, you know, what your symptoms are and where you are, you may be offered assistance breathing. If you were, you know, coughing a lot, they may suggest some cough medication for you. But it's really, it's not going to, you know, sort of clear the virus. It's going to treat the symptoms and try to make sure that you're as comfortable as possible.
And if you do wind up, say, you're going home, you're staying home, staying away from other people, is it okay, even if you start to feel better, to check in with the doctor? A lot of times, doctor, when we feel better, we just forget about it and go about our lives and don't check back in. But in this case, is it a good idea to check back in to let everyone know what your progress is?
If you have a confirmed case of novel coronavirus, we will be checking in with you.
Okay.
You're not going to be given any options, and you actually will not be allowed to leave sort of an isolation setting. You can isolate at home until you've had two negative tests for the virus 24 hours apart. So you are very closely monitored, and you will be in touch with your public health department. And if you're ill, obviously, and particularly if you're severely ill, you may even be hospitalized, and obviously an entire team of clinicians will be working with you. But even those with mild illness who have a confirmed case, they will need to stay isolated. That means fully isolated. You're not allowed out of your house. You can't really be in contact with other people for as long as it takes for them to have two negative tests that are 24 hours apart.
Talking to Barbara Ferrer, director of the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health. What is LA's ability to test for it as it stands?
Sure. We're one of a handful of places in California. We have a public health lab. We have the test kits. We are actively testing, and we'll continue to actively test. We're also a fairly sophisticated lab, and we will be seeking approval for an alternative test so that we can use our test kits that are now supplied by CDC. But if there was ever a problem with those test kits, we will have an alternative way that's been approved by the FDA for us to do an alternative test that's equally reliable. So we plan on, being able to test as appropriate for the virus. I think it's important for folks to understand that there are criteria that is set by the Centers for Disease Control on who will get tested, and all of our labs are adhering to that criteria. And it really is, the test is really not offered, for the most part, to people who are asymptomatic. So I know there are people who are worried. I traveled to Italy, I just got home, I have no symptoms, I feel fine, but, I want to go get tested. I want to make sure I don't have the virus. It's not likely that you would be tested unless you develop symptoms.
Okay. Now, the outbreak in Washington State, 9 casualties there, has been traced back to a senior care facility. Any idea why older people seem to be more vulnerable to coronavirus?
I think it's similar to, sort of people whose immune system isn't working as well. Older people generally have more health issues, and generally their immune systems aren't necessarily in as good shape as for younger people. And again, the virus is fought off by your own immune system. So if you've got compromises and you have other health conditions, your immune system just can get weaker and weaker, and not only unable to respond effectively to this virus, but also you can have, sort of an exacerbation of underlying health conditions that also can flare up because now your immune system is so taxed by a new virus. So I think in layman's term, that's probably the easiest way to explain why elderly people, people with underlying health conditions, are both more at risk, it seems like, for being able to contract the virus. But more importantly for us, they're likely to experience more serious illness, which is why across the country, we talk about the vulnerable populations as the places where we really need to focus our efforts. And certainly elderly people and people with underlying health conditions are what we would consider vulnerable populations for a new virus. And we would be working diligently with all of the care facilities that work with our aging population, so that we can help them both do a good job on infection control, but also, manage situations should they have positive cases and or close contacts of positive cases.
Now, the story of the senior care center has put people on high alert about socializing and also public gatherings, and we've seen a number of institutions implementing policies to mitigate the spread of the virus. I want to get your take, Doctor, on a few of these, starting with LAUSD. So let's listen to what LA Unified School District Superintendent Austin Buettner had to say about scenarios that they're planning for.
We're also making plans for learning to continue from home if any schools were to be closed, as well as the possibility of extending the school year to make up for disruption in the school calendar if necessary.
Worst case scenario, Doctor, if the disease were to spread here, which agency or public official has the authority to close schools? Would it be a decision that comes from the Department of Public Health?
So, obviously our health officer can, in fact, issue orders to close schools, and we're prepared to issue those orders, and we've communicated that to all of our school districts. We would never make a decision like that in isolation of school administrators, though. I mean, this is a partnership. We've been on calls with school districts since the very beginning in January, so that folks can be prepared, both for steps people can take to sort of slow down transmission, but then should there be transmission, particularly within their school community, but also should we just see sort of tons and tons of cases in the community at large, we do want schools to be prepared. What would you do if you needed to close? It could be one school that we're requesting needs to close, or it could be a number of schools. You know, in general, we work with the administrators. We've asked that they communicate with families so that, and we're communicating with families. You need to have a plan. What will happen if a school closed, you know, closes? I want to be really clear that when we close a school, because there's been a lot of exposure in the school, so there's been a couple of cases or even one case, but a lot of students were exposed to that one case, or a lot of staff were exposed to that one case, and we decide there's so many people that need to be quarantined that it makes sense to actually close the school. Can't really stay open under those conditions. Parents, unfortunately, that's not the time where you're going to go and find an after-school program
right.
that's open for the day. You really need to, you're being asked to quarantine at home, and that means you have to kind of stay isolated. And that means employers have to support parents who may need to stay home should there be a school closure.
That's Dr. Barbara Ferrer, director of the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health. Doctor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, we'll head back out to some voting centers around LA to hear how it's going in the county. That's some more Take Two coming right up. Stay tuned. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. It is Super Tuesday, so all day we've been checking in on the polls. In LA County, as we've been reporting, there's a whole new way of doing things with voting centers instead of traditional neighborhood polling places, and people are using modern touchscreens to mark their ballots. The new system has been under a big spotlight, but for the most part, so far, so good. So let's turn now to KPCC producer Natalie Chudnovsky. She joins us now from the Ace Hotel downtown. Hey, Natalie.
Hey.
Now, there have been some reports, I've actually seen it myself, long lines at some voting centers, but what issues, if any, have you found where you're at?
Yeah, definitely long lines. So I'm on the second floor of the Ace where the vote center is situated here, and the line snakes through the building and outside eastward down Broadway, and it's a hot day, so people are sweating. The LA County Center lead told me that the estimates she's heard are 2 to 2.5 hours in line. And that rings true with the people that I've talked to who just finished voting, that the whole process took about 2.5 hours. And the problem seems to be that the ACE vote center is actually a micro center, which means that they only have 7 machines. So some of the nearby centers have 50 machines, 40 machines. This one is a micro center. They've been open since Saturday, and they've had very low turnout, so they didn't really expect the wave of people to come, and they've just been overwhelmed. They have sent for 2 more voting machines and 2 more registration machines, but, you know, considering the amount of people outside, that still probably means a pretty long wait.
Now, Natalie, I've heard of some mobile units driving around L.A. to try and relieve some of the pressure on the long lines. Have you heard that, too?
I asked Marisol Rubio, the L.A. County Center lead at the ACE, about that, and she hasn't heard anything, but they are asking for just more regular voting machines, and those are on the way.
Now, who have you spoken with, and how are people generally responding to the new voting centers and the touchscreens?
The reviews of the touchscreens have been pretty positive. I talked to one woman who was impressed with all the language options, and I talked to another woman named Rochelle Burchett who used the app, which lets you fill out your ballot at home, and then it gives you a QR code, so you can just put that QR code, get it scanned, and expedite the process. But most of the friction really seems to be from the two and a half hour wait line. Not so much from the voting machines themselves.
One more thing, Natalie, only because everyone's touching those machines. Any hand sanitizer? Enough for everyone to go around?
There are Clorox wipes on the registration table, but no hand sanitizer that I've seen provided for voters. And it is a good point because there is actually free pizza provided by either the Ace Hotel or the Vote Center. I'm not sure, so everyone's grabbing that on the way out after voting, so maybe bring your own hand sanitizer.
KPCC's Natalie Chudnovsky from a voting center downtown. Natalie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, now, if you still haven't cast your vote, you do have until 8 p.m. tonight, and some of your 11th hour voters have been sending in questions to KPCC's Voter Game Plan team. Now, with the answers to some of those questions is Audience Engagement Editor Brianna Lee. Welcome back, Brianna.
Hi.
All right, so what do people want to know on Election Day?
So one last-minute question we are getting is, can I still register to vote? And as a reminder, yes, you can. California has same-day registration. So if you are eligible to vote, you can register at any voting center from now until polls close at 8 p.m. It is not too late. And the same goes not just for registration, but for also changing your party affiliation. You can also do that today at a voting center. You just walk right in and you can get somebody to help you do it. We got a few questions from people who had received sample ballots for the wrong party, people who had registered with one party but wanted to vote in a different party's primary. So whatever your situation is, you can go and update your party affiliation today at a voting center.
Now, you can register to vote if you're homeless as well, right?
Yes, you can. When you fill out the registration form, you just have to supply an intersection for where you're staying when it asks for your address so that it can just assign you a precinct for voting. You will also need to put in a mailing address to get future voting material, so you can just use either a P.O. box or the address of a family or friend, just anywhere you can get mail. If you are homeless and you are having trouble checking in to vote, just putting in your address for the intersection into the field where you're supposed to check in, an election worker should call the registrar recorder's office to get your precinct number, and that way they can issue you the correct ballot. And finally, we're getting a lot of questions from people who are wondering where exactly they can vote. Can I vote in a different city from where I live? What about a different county? So just to clear a couple of things up, you can vote in any vote center in the county in which you are registered. So if you are registered in LA County and say you live in Torrance and you want to vote in Long Beach, you can absolutely do that. It's as long as it's in the same county.
Yeah.
Because once you check in, it will be able to pull up your personal ballot with all of your local races on it. But you cannot vote in a different county. So if you are registered in LA County, you cannot vote in Orange County. You cannot vote in San Diego County. They will not have a ballot for you. You can only vote in LA County. And so some people have been asking, well, can I turn in my vote by mail ballot in a different county from where I am registered? So if you just drop it in a mailbox, then sure, you just have to get it postmarked by election day. It's got to be received by the registrar within 3 days. So if you drop it in anywhere today, you can just put it into any mailbox wherever. It's totally fine. It is better to drop it in a mailbox than to do it in a vote center in a different county, just to avoid any potential confusion.
That's right. I didn't think of that. Now, you're going to continue to answer people's questions all day long about voting.
Yeah, we have a whole voter
Good.
Game plan
Glad to
team
hear you say that.
That's here specifically to answer voters' questions for the rest of Election Day. We've got a whole bunch coming in. We're answering them as fast as we can. So if you still have questions, you can submit them on our website at las.com/elections.
That's one more time, las.com/elections. Brianna Lee, KPCC's Audience Engagement Editor. Brianna, thanks a lot.
Hi, thanks.
All right, take a high-profile murder, add a secret love triangle, then sprinkle in an L.A. County homicide detective who's jaded because she knows that the only reason she's on the case assigned to it is because she's a woman. Then you got the new novel, Lost Hills, a story about how investigating a crime in California can be especially difficult, especially when sexism gets in the way. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Hi, back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. All right, let's take a break, a little break, small break from Election Day, shall we? Tell me if this sounds like a familiar premise for a detective novel. High-profile murder case, jaded detective, secret love triangle, a smash-bang finish. Now, those are all cliches author Lee Goldberg aimed to avoid when writing his latest novel, Lost Hills, a story set in Los Angeles. It tells the fictional story of a newly hired homicide detective named Eve Ronan, who quickly finds herself in over her head. But her inexperience soon proves to be an advantage when she and her partner are called to a bloody crime scene where the body are nowhere to be found. Here's author Lee Goldberg talking about his book, Lost Hills.
I set Eve's story in Los Angeles because it's a world I know. But at the same time, I was nervous about it because telling a police story in Los Angeles means you're bumping up against Michael Connelly and Raymond Chandler and Joseph Wamba. And I didn't want to do what they did, and I didn't think I could do what they did as well as they did. So I picked my own little corner of Los Angeles, the Lost Hills Station jurisdiction of Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. A world unto itself, an island within the urban Los Angeles landscape. It was a way to explore a corner of Los Angeles that is Los Angeles in a microcosm and yet hadn't been explored before. The Lost Hills jurisdiction is bound by Los Angeles, Woodland Hills, Ventura County, and the Pacific Ocean. So it embodies rural Los Angeles, it embodies the mountains, it embodies Topanga Canyon and the hippie-dippy lifestyle. It embodies Hidden Hills and the celebrities of Malibu and the gated communities of Calabasas, the rural areas of Agoura. It is a world unto itself, filled with stories, filled with conflict, and filled with every walk of life. There are some dangers in doing a police procedural. There are cliches that you can run into, but there are also expectations the readers have for a police procedural. So I wanted to give the readers what they want and run as far away as I possibly could from the cliches. To do that, I came up with a character that I thought was very different from the typical cynical, tired male cop who's drinking and is divorced and his superiors hate him and he's carrying a dark tragedy behind him, be it experience in a war or a serial killer who murdered his family, whatever. I opted instead for a young woman who didn't have that baggage, who's looking at the city and herself anew and thought it might offer the reader a chance to look at California and Los Angeles and the police procedural anew. This story was born from a real case. I had a different crime story in mind that I wanted to write. As research, I attended a homicide investigators training conference in Green Bay, Wisconsin. I wanted to pick up some color, some police procedure, some interesting facts. And while I was there, a case was presented as an example of the importance of approaching each homicide as if you've never investigated a homicide before. That this particular case would not have been solved if the detectives walked into it with any of the so-called police common sense. And I found this particular case absolutely fascinating. I knew I had to write about it. So I threw out the book I had in mind and started thinking about this story as the inspiration for my case. But since this case required a detective to throw out everything he knew about detecting, not in terms of how you go about an investigation, but common sense assumptions you might make about a case based on the evidence, I realized I had to have a newbie detective, someone who'd never investigated a homicide before. But to become a homicide detective, you need to gain a lot of experience. It's a big promotion. So how do I pull that off? Well, what if my heroine got this job not out of experience or merit, but because of publicity? What if she leveraged her way in? What if she truly was a newbie, doing a job she didn't deserve and knew it, and had to prove herself on the fly? And that's where the whole character of Eve Ronan came from, being able to create a character who could approach this case completely fresh, because she is completely fresh. I want to tell a story about a strong woman, a young woman, finding herself. And I also want to tell a story about a character who doesn't have all the answers, who makes big mistakes, who has to prove herself along the way, but that doesn't make her weak, it makes her strong. And I wanted the reader to be able to grow with her as she gains that experience, because I envisioned this as a series, and I wanted somewhere to go. And if you start with a character who's already great, who's already confident, who already is sure of herself, that doesn't leave you any room for conflict and growth. So what if I had a character who had the ambition and the energy and the instincts, but not the experience, who was still making mistakes and learning from those mistakes and incorporating that knowledge into what she was doing? Without giving too much away, the finale of my book is set in amidst a wildfire in Calabasas. I live in Calabasas, and I'm aware of all the dry brush around me, and I've seen the other fires that were going on. So I envisioned this epic fire that would eat up most of the Santa Monica Mountains and sweep across this corner of Southern California, sort of a cleansing in the midst of my investigation. I had no way of knowing that I was predicting the future. I had the ironic experience of editing my galleys about a wildfire going through the Santa Monica Mountains while I was evacuated from my home and watching the fire footage on TV and seeing that I got it right. There are so many cliches about the police procedural and even more cliches about Los Angeles. I'm hoping with this book to break some of those cliches, to tell the police procedural in a different way, but also show an entirely different side of LA that we haven't seen to death in other police procedurals and in television shows.
That's author Lee Goldberg talking about his new LA-based murder mystery, Lost Hills, and that segment was produced by Tamika Adams and Austin Cross. Now, by the way, if you were heading to Ace Hotel to vote, got a tweet from listener Melanie Smith. She says, send voters to Union Station, 10 minutes away from the Ace. It's at Metro HQ. And our senior politics reporter Libby Denkman just confirmed that Metro HQ, just east of Union Station, has light traffic right now. She tweeted that back to me about 4 or 5 minutes ago. So traffic should be still light there. And here are the directions. Go all the way through Union Station, exit upstairs through the south doors, and you will see the voting signs. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.